I need a shot of motivation. So I sit on the tarmac at the Denver airport looking out the window at a sky that can't decide whether to drop snowflakes or icy sleet. The plane engines hum as a fleet of de-icing machines descend on the aircraft like droids from a dystopian future. The vehicles are little more than tankards of antifreeze with thin hydraulic arms that hold workmen in small, elevated glass cabins. The contraptions spray down the wings with chemical cannons. Four such machines coat the plane until it is so slick that the wings reflect the glare of the yellow airport lights. Unlucky snowflakes that make contact with the wings vanish in puffs. Humanity's fight against the elements always has new fronts. Without the chemical spew, ice might undermine the delicate aerodynamics of the aircraft and send us careening into the Atlantic. And so, I begin to wonder how my own fight against the ice will go. 9 hours and a connection in London later, Anam Hoff, Wim's son and business manager, meets me at the Schiphol airport wearing a wide grin. Anam leads me to a small Audi sports car, and as we take off down the highway, he explains how he's transformed the chaos of his father's teachings into a coherent and profitable business called Inner Fire. When we'd first met in 2012, Wim had not yet achieved international fame. Since then, a wildly popular documentary on the HBO series Vice, countless podcasts, news articles, and maybe my own story in Playboy had spread the message across the world. Would-be followers wanted to learn how to perform similar feats in the ice, and a growing scientific literature was lending credence to his claims that the method could hijack the autonomic nervous system. A key driver in this sudden interest is that the technique isn't very difficult to learn. All it takes is a bit of mental fortitude and strong lungs. But what alchemy allows ice baths, mental focus, and deep breathing to crack into the autonomic nervous system? The science is sometimes confusing, even contradictory. Despite my experiences with the Wim Hof method, it still seems too good to be true, and the skeptic in me wonders if perhaps it is. Maybe there is a secret, deeper technique that I haven't picked up yet. There has to be more. It is one thing to meet already impressive athletes who claim that the method pushes them to a new level, and it is quite another to find that level yourself. A measly ski hill in Poland isn't enough. I want my own Everest, some impossible feat that I can overcome for myself and afterward look out at the world a little stronger than I have any right to. In January, Hoff plans to summit the tallest mountain in Africa, Mount Kilimanjaro, a soaring 19,341 feet above sea level in just 2 shirtless days. The trek won't be all that difficult from a mountaineering perspective, but doing it Hoff's way is a serious test of human mettle. Kilimanjaro isn't formidable because of rock slides or long slope ascents on bare rock walls, but for its high incidence of altitude sickness in expeditions. As a hiker trudges upward, the air grows ever thinner and the atmospheric pressure ever lower. Eventually, the air gets so sparse that oxygen can't circulate efficiently throughout the body. When the dizziness progresses to full-blown acute mountain sickness, AMS for short, the heart starts to beat irregularly, and the lungs can fill with fluid until it becomes impossible to breathe. 5 to 10 people die every year on Kilimanjaro ascents. To stave off this condition, mountaineers slowly acclimate on their way to the top, ascending in easy stages so that their bodies can produce more red blood cells and get used to the thinning air. Alternately, they dose themselves with a drug called Diamox, which helps them adapt to the altitude. A typical Kilimanjaro ascent takes a minimum of 5 days, plus another 3 or 4 to get back down. Even going at that pace, Only about 45% of people who attempt the summit make it. Hoff claims that with focus and concentrated breathing, he can take 20 people to the summit at a pace that most mountaineers would call reckless. But then again, it sounds exactly like the sort of challenge that I need to prove that the training has actually changed me. But my plans hit a snag. For reasons that I do not entirely understand, a few months earlier, Anum put the kibosh on my request to accompany Wim to the top. The trip is mysteriously full every time I ask, and there is never more space on its roster. I have a feeling that there is a deeper problem, and that one of my goals in coming to Holland is to secure a space on the expedition. The journey from Amsterdam to the training center takes almost an hour. Anum pilots his sports car through a densely packed highway of economy cars, swerving through traffic and expertly slowing down for automatic cameras that are set up to catch speeders like him. The center is located just outside a tiny village called Stroo and has been part of the organization for only a few weeks. It is just one sign of the exponential growth of all things Wim Hof in the last 4 years. Early in his career, Hof suffered from a series of bad business deals with a string of managers who pushed him into shooting stunts that garnered media headlines, but which made people think of him more as a circus act than a metabolic genius. As he climbed most of the way up Mount Everest and ran across the Arctic barefoot, various managers pocketed the lion's share of the proceeds. Anum took over the operations in 2010, founding Inner Fire and urging his father to do fewer stunts and instead lend his body for scientific research. The move made Hoff's affairs a family business. And, under Anum's direction, the company produced a 10-week online video course that spread virally in online forums and through tens of thousands of Facebook posts. Together, they created a standardized teacher training program to certify people as Wim Hof Method instructors who could spread the message without needing direct supervision from Hof himself. In the next few days, 100 of them would take a midterm exam in Stroo to see if they'd qualify to take the same course in Poland that I had completed several years earlier. Now, the Iceman is a household name in the Netherlands. His workshops sell out within minutes, and lecture venues easily fill with 600 souls. Every month, about 1,000 people sign up to take his 10-week online course. It is hard to imagine how it would have grown as large as it has without Anum taking the reins. Under his direction, the business expanded operations from the Netherlands, Poland, and Spain to an intercontinental audience across the Atlantic. For a journalist looking to tell Wim's story, however, Anum can be something of a roadblock. Part of Anum's vision is to keep the message about the method on point, focused on science, and less so on the aura of chaos that seems to follow everything that Wim touches. Because I am someone who has seen Wim emerge from the shadows, Anum might think of me as a bit of a liability. Or perhaps Anum is simply worried that I might not make it to the top, something that certainly wouldn't do Wim's image any good. So, with this in mind, I keep the conversation light. The sun is just going down as we pull into the gravel driveway. The new training center is a converted metalworking shop that hasn't quite made the transition to New Age ashram. The two-story villa still has paintings of the previous owner's children hanging on the wall. Its hallway opens into a barren kitchen with heated floors and a dog hair encrusted sofa. A pervasive smell of mildew emanates from every crack in the walls, and only a couch, flat-screen TV, and a broad, leafy houseplant make up the furnishings in the living room. This is all going to change, Anum says of the rough accommodations. We have a meeting with an architect in a few days. What I am seeing is at best a work in progress. It isn't at all clear where I am going to sleep, and when I ask Anum, he shrugs and waves me upstairs. Of the four rooms on the second floor, there is only one piece of furniture, a bed with a broken spring in the middle. At the foot is the sum total of Wim's personal wardrobe, a white plastic trash bag full of dirty clothes, a hopelessly wrinkled white sports coat, an orange swimsuit, and a few towels. The pile sits discarded on a stained brown carpet. I stare at the collection for a minute. Part of me despairs what a week in such Spartan quarters will feel like, while the other part marvels at the disjunction between the worldwide fame and riches associated with a training empire and the way Hoff chooses to live. Wim is many things, but he is clearly not motivated by material trappings. Anum calls up from downstairs. "I think my dad usually sleeps on the couch," he says. "You can probably take his bed." So I put my rolling suitcase on the floor. Anum leaves, and an hour or so later, around midnight, Wim pulls up outside in a large, yellow Ford van. He comes inside wearing a t-shirt, nurse scrubs, and a black suit jacket. Next to him is Anton, the tall, red-headed American whose mop of hair resembles that of the comedian Carrot Top. Anton is traveling around Europe after a stint learning Wim's method and is trading accommodation for some work around the house. Considering the bare-bones accommodations, I wonder if we'll be in competition for the only bed. "Scott Carney, you motherfucker!" Wim yells into the small room with a jovial smile on his face. It's meant to be a compliment of sorts. The curse words are the newest tool in his English arsenal and have been reprinted 1,000 times on a t-shirt with the company logo, interposed with the slogan, "Breathe, motherfucker." Wim has no time for pretense, and sometimes jokes with his instructors that the people who complete his courses earn their MF degree when they are done with his training. The insult, which might make me angry in another context, instead provokes a cracked smile on my face. You know what? It has been far too long since I've seen this motherfucker. For the last few hours, he has been trying to set a new Guinness World Record for getting the largest number of people ever to walk on an ice rink barefoot. The event took place in a small village on the other side of Holland. By the time it was over, the crowd's communal body heat melted the top layer into slush. Hoff is still energized by the sight of the drag queens, the school groups, and the endless streams of well-wishers who have been drawn into his orbit. Although it is late, Hoff has the vitality of a man a quarter of his age. We sit together on the couch and chat for several hours. In the last few years, Hoff went from being an unknown to a world-famous guru. And he says he is struggling to understand what it means to be an icon as well as the figurehead on the prow of a several million-dollar-a-year business. The constant lecturing, workshops, and media appearances are not what he is built for. He'd much rather be a madman than a prophet. But with great power comes great responsibility. So Hoff has to zero in on the kind of highly refined message that can captivate the largest possible audience. He tries a slogan on me. It's just 3 words. "Happy, healthy, strong," he says with pride. "I just want to keep it simple." These, he says, are the 3 ingredients to a good life. Forget for a minute the science behind breathing and the cold, the barbaric discomfort of ice water, or how many push-ups a person might be able to do without breathing. They are all just trappings of a larger desire to live well. From there, we descend into a more detailed discussion of what it means to live a good life. Hoff starts to speak quicker, like he is agitated. He begins to wave his arms in the air as if he is keeping a small insect at bay. "Society is sick," he says. "Have you ever seen a rabbit go to a pharmacy, a hospital, a mental asylum?" he asks rhetorically. "They don't look for medicine. They heal themselves or die. Humans aren't so simple. They've let technology get in the way of who they really are." It's an idea that I've thought a lot about, and one that doesn't always sit comfortably. Yes, the modern world has its drawbacks. but nature can be brutal. And so I interrupt the budding diatribe. But rabbits get eaten by wolves, I say. Hoff doesn't skip a beat at my interjection. Yes, they know fight and flight. The wolf chases them and they die. But everything dies one day. It's just that, in our case, we aren't being eaten by wolves. Instead, without predators, we are being eaten by cancer, by diabetes, and our own immune systems. There is no wolf to run from, so our bodies eat themselves. This is, of course, the core of Wim's philosophy. Without something to fight against, the body will fight itself. They are words to muse over for the next week. Before I shuffle off to bed, Wim offers to let me tag along for a morning excursion with the Dutch Olympic sailing team as they make their preparations for the 2016 Games. He is going to lecture them on what it means to be strong and how to stay at the top of their game in any weather. 8 hours later, I take my inaugural shower and transform his house into a rainstorm. Wim's dance only ends when the rain from his ceiling slows to a trickle. Fortunately, it doesn't actually collapse. In the joy of the moment, he forgets to check the time and realizes that we need to be on the other side of Holland in less than an hour. I'll be sharing a seat with his dog in the cab of his bright yellow van. A minute or two later, we are on the highway trying to transmute an hour into 40 minutes by stepping on the gas. "Nothing to worry about," he smiles as his blue eyes focus on the road. "They are going to learn patience today, too." The drive gives us time to talk, and for me to slip the idea that perhaps it would be fun if I joined the Kilimanjaro expedition. The group, which has grown to 26 people, all agreed to practice the method for half a year and meet up every week to breathe and then jump into one of Amsterdam's canals or shallow lakes. Sure, I've missed some of the camaraderie, but I live at a higher altitude and have been training on and off in the method since we summited Snezka. How much harder could this mountain be? Hoff doesn't skip a beat responding. "Of course," he says with his usual enthusiasm. "Not only should you come, you must come." He starts punching buttons on his phone, taking his eyes off the road long enough for a graceful swerve into the neighboring lane before he finds Anum's number. Guttural notes of Dutch flit between them, and it seems that Wim's recommendation is all that is required to get me on the list. "Scott Carney is coming," Wim says empathetically in English. There is a short argument, but eventually Anne accented, "No problem." I smile and realize that I don't really know what I've gotten myself into. That unknown, along with a few thousand dollars, are my cost of entry. It isn't long until we arrive at the outskirts of The Hague, and the GPS begins to recalculate the route. It recommends an immediate exit from the highway, over a bridge somewhere to the north. Hoff swerves through traffic, but once we've made it onto the new stretch of asphalt, the GPS pushes back into rerouting mode and tells us to make a U-turn. We both scowl inwardly, hoping that the GPS unit can feel shame. We are supposed to go south now, but the gadget isn't offering an apology. It is precisely the sort of problem we would have never encountered 10 years ago. But even the Iceman finds the convenience of modern technology alluring. "I hate them, but I can't get anywhere without one of these anymore," he says as we spin the vehicle around. 10 minutes later, Hoff parks outside a plain brick building just as the gray sky turns to rain. He opens the door, jumps out, and ducks into a construction site to relieve himself. As he pisses, a thought seems to occur to him, and he calls back to me that before Kilimanjaro, I should really meet Geert Boos, a doctor who had joined him on the expedition up Kilimanjaro 2 years before. Wim says that Boos knows what I am going to face better than anyone else, and that maybe he could better explain the dangers of what altitude really are. With that, he puts himself back together and is ready to meet the Olympians. It is the same lecture he's given countless times before, but the team, which already bristles with gold medals, listens intently for anything that might give them an edge in Brazil. And indeed, it may well have. In the 2016 Games, Dutch sailors won 2 gold medals. I sit in the back of the room with my mind wandering to Buse. As Hoff leads the sailors in a breathing session, and then an after-lecture ice bath in a blue inflatable birthing pool, I send an email to the doctor hoping for a chance to pick his brain about my upcoming trip to Africa. The next day, Geert Buse is waiting for me in a swanky hotel on the outskirts of Amsterdam, sipping on a foamy cappuccino. At first, I don't recognize him. A few hours earlier, I'd taken a tour of his resume online, and the list of accomplishments made me picture a man in the twilight of his career. An orthopedic surgeon with both an MD and a PhD to his credit, he has also done stints in the trauma center at Mass General Hospital in Boston, and published research on high-altitude climbing, ligament reconstruction, and on the tendency for misquotes in peer-reviewed scientific papers. In his spare time, he climbs mountains. The list, which goes on for a few pages, made me figure that the guy must have had at least 30 years on me. So when my eyes lock on an aristocratically handsome man in his mid-30s, I am surprised to see him wave. "I just Googled you," he says, pointing to my face on his computer screen. "We certainly have a lot to talk about." In 2014, Buse joined Hoff and 23 other climbers on a remarkably similar trip to the one that I am planning to go on. They summited Kilimanjaro in just a few days without any acclimatization. Initially content simply to be a participant in the crew, Buse's medical credentials eventually made him a perfect candidate to be the expedition's doctor. Anum asked him if maybe he would write an academic paper about the experience. The 2014 Kilimanjaro expedition presented Buse with an intimidating set of responsibilities. At least half of the group suffered from one chronic illness or another. One man had cancer, and there were people with serious heart conditions, chronic arthritis, and an assortment of autoimmune diseases. All of this compounded the obvious threat of acute mountain sickness, or AMS. Looking for some advice about the actual risks from other mountaineers, Buse reached out to a mountaineering club in the Netherlands to learn more, but they tried to warn him off. "They told me that someone would die," he says, and then thinks about it. "Actually, they told me everyone would die." That wasn't the sort of encouragement he was looking for, so he looked to the academic literature for a second opinion. An article in the New England Journal of Medicine, NEJM, analyzed the ascents of 312 hikers, all of whom attempted to get to the top of Kilimanjaro in just 5 days. It was the closest cognate to what his own group would be doing, except that in this case, Buse and his fellow climbers would aim to reach the summit in just 48 hours and do most of the climb bare-chested. Even so, the numbers were grim. Of the hikers analyzed in the NEJM study, only 61% made it to the top, while 77% developed AMS, including a few cases of the most severe form of the condition, hyperbaric hypoxia. The mountaineering club's warning didn't seem too far off after all. Hyperbaric hypoxia is a nasty condition. Although the Earth's atmosphere is 21% oxygen regardless of altitude, the lower overall air pressure at higher elevations means the higher a person goes up, the less oxygen there is available for any given breath. While it can take a long time to die of starvation, oxygen depletion can wreak havoc on the body in mere hours as it shuts down one critical system after another. Typical low-level symptoms include headache, nausea, fatigue, inability to sleep, and dizziness. At more severe stages, at the point where AMS gets a Latin name, people lose their balance and fluid begins to collect in their extremities. Once severe symptoms set in, there's no way to reverse the process until the patient descends to a lower altitude. Absolutely everything in the literature indicated that Hoff's expedition was a suicide mission. I knew that I had a responsibility to warn the group, Buse recounts. The expedition wasn't just a high-risk affair, it bordered on stupid. The sole thing in the hikers' favor was their faith that the rapid breathing, along with a half-year process of conditioning their bodies to the cold, might, theoretically, provide a certain level of protection. If the entire group breathed consciously during the ascent, it might compensate for the low overall oxygen at higher altitude. After all, that was essentially how Diamox worked. The altitude acclimatization drug passively speeds up respiration to counteract the lower saturation of oxygen at altitude. In theory, Hoff's breathing method would take the pharmaceutical out of the equation, but produce the same basic result. That said, even if the method worked for most people, what would happen if one member of the group fell ill? Would they be able to maintain their concentration and breathing while simultaneously mounting a rescue operation? In a worst-case scenario, the entire group could fall like dominoes. As one person attempted to rescue another, they could well succumb to the same environmental factors until the whole team became incapacitated. The prospect gave him nightmares. But on the other hand, what if they made it? If a simple breathing technique could defeat AMS, then there was potential to help climbers around the world who found themselves in trouble at elevation. So Buse made a plan. As the first wilderness EMT to ever take on a challenge like this, he designed his own set of safety protocols. His emails and messages to the group highlighted their potential dooms, and he started to get a reputation among the other mountaineers for being a worrywart. I needed to get them to understand exactly how serious this was. It is easy to get caught up in the fun of the expedition and believe that everything would be okay. I needed to scare them a little, he says. Eventually, his imploring prevailed. They all agreed to abide by following a simple buddy system that would make everyone responsible for a climbing partner. He found a checklist of altitude sickness symptoms, known as the Lake Louise criteria, that would provide canned ratings and symptoms to watch out for during their progress on the ascent. Since altitude sickness manifests differently in every person, the protocol ranks a variety of likely complications as an expedition ascends higher. Every symptom gets a point value. A mild headache is worth 1 point. Severe dizziness ranks as a 3. And every mildly swollen limb on a person's body is worth 1 point, for a maximum of 4 points, one for each limb. Everyone agreed that if anyone scored a 5, they would stop and hold their position on the mountain until the symptoms subsided. If someone scored a 7 or more, the two buddies would turn back. After the trip, Buse would use the rankings that people recorded and analyze them for his paper. So, while beforehand the crew worried about how they might fare on the mountain, the actual trip was a great success. It has gone down in Wim Hof lore as one of the most profound tests of the method. A few months after their expedition, Buse published a letter to the editor in the Journal of Wilderness and Environmental Medicine, stating that out of the 25 people on the journey, only one experienced severe symptoms. This single man with a heart condition had to descend early. Everyone else made it to the rim of the volcano. Almost all of them were shirtless the whole time. The 92% success rate was unheard of in medical literature, or as Buse wrote in Reserved Medical Speak in his letter, the method seems to have a direct biological effect on the autonomic nervous system and warrants further investigation. The remarkable results are likely explained by the continuous controlled hyperventilation reducing hypoxia severity. However, the resultant state of respiratory alkalosis may cause symptoms such as dizziness and visual disturbances. The fact that none of the trekkers experienced such symptoms is most likely due to the long-term training. So it worked! It was a huge success, and Hoff repeated it a year later with a different group. I am relieved. But Buse is not willing to assure me that the next expedition will be the same. We know that it has worked, but exactly what factors go into success are hard to say. It's still a very dangerous proposition. It's not like people haven't died following Wim's example before, he adds, almost as an afterthought. One side effect of Hoff's sudden international recognition is that tens of thousands of people want to perform their own versions of Hoff's feats. Over the years, Hoff himself has sometimes paid a physical price for his daredevil adventures, but he has always managed to come out the other end alive and smiling. Not so for all of the people following his method. In the previous winter, two Dutchmen started learning Hoff's breathing techniques from YouTube videos and found that they loved being in cold water. When one particular cold front froze the surfaces of the canals, they challenged each other to swim beneath a stretch of ice. Whereas an emergency diver was on hand to rescue Hoff when he lost track of the hole in the ice and his corneas froze while attempting a similar swim, the two friends were neither as well prepared nor as lucky. One of them drowned. The death cast a certain pall on the Inner Fire organization. When I ask him about it later, Anum says, "We can't be responsible for every extreme action that people say is inspired by Wim. That would be impossible. There are just too many factors." He's right. While it's true that the Hoff method helps push the limits of human achievement, nature will win eventually if you constantly test it. That evening, I pilot a tiny economy rental car back to Struve and wait in the empty house for Hoff to get back home. For a 56-year-old man, his schedule seems endless. There are lectures in the morning and evening, halls packed with corporate executives seeking to use his method to train to be better leaders, as well as nonstop requests from people suffering from debilitating illnesses who see the Iceman and his method as a last-ditch hope. He texted me earlier saying that he was on a special mission out of the country and he would be back late. The night drags on until eventually I again hear the crunch of Hoff's tires on the gravel outside. The engine purrs for a few minutes as he sits behind the wheel, thinking and breathing consciously to find his center. Eventually he opens the door and I notice that his rumpled suit coat looks even more rumpled than it did in the morning. I want to ask him about how the person died swimming under the ice, but it doesn't seem like a good time. He smiles at me faintly. "I saved a woman's life today," he says softly. After a moment or two, he tells me that he was just back from Brussels, an almost 250-mile drive round trip. There, a woman had called him saying that he was her last hope before she took her own life. He figured that he didn't have a choice but to at least try to help. She was hurt. Her hips and pelvis were broken as a child, and since then she has only known pain. "So I spent the day with her and tried opening her up," he says. Hoff taught her a technique to dull the pain and retrain her nerves. "She still has a long journey ahead of her. And I don't know for sure," Hoff says. "But I think she'll be okay." I am beginning to feel the same way about Kilimanjaro. It is a little more than 2 weeks before we are scheduled to fly to Tanzania, but Hoff has other things to think about besides my budding fears around the trip. He shuffles off into the kitchen and looks to scrounge up his first meal of the day. He ponders over some mayonnaise and some pickled shellfish in a jar. The man who spent the morning dancing in a rainstorm in his own living room nods at the meal, as if he's saying, "It'll do." Chapter 9. Parkinson's, Broken Bones, Arthritis, and Crohn's. In the middle of the night, Hans Spahns growls into his pillow as the cramps slowly overwhelm him. The muscles tighten in his thighs, back, calves, and arms in a relentless Charlie horse. His body is a hard knot of paralyzing pain, but at least he still has his voice. His body is a hard knot of paralyzing pain, but at least he still has his voice. So he lets an unholy string of words fly from his mouth and into the cotton casing. The cries gain power with every passing second until eventually the sounds of anger and agony fall to a whisper. Somehow, the rage gives him the strength to stumble onto his feet and kick a couple of pillows around the room with the brutal force reminiscent of someone who had studied martial arts in their youth. And then, as the anger fades away, just like that, the cramps are gone. He can move again. If Spahns has learned one thing in the 14 years since he was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease, it is that sometimes he can swear his symptoms into submission. It all started back in 2002 when Spahns was still working as an outsourcing consultant for a Dutch subsidiary of the IT company Unisys. His was a fast and intense life that followed the mantras, "I want it all now," and "the sky is the limit, if at all." At age 41, he had no thought of ever slowing down or living a more stable life, and he had no issues about working overtime on projects just so long as they were high profile. He enjoyed the benefits of the bachelor life, driving fast cars, sailing a boat on the lakes and waterways of the Netherlands, and skiing throughout the winter. That year, on a solo skiing trip in the Banff area of the Canadian Rockies, he took a tumble on the slopes. He broke his left pinky finger and damaged his right hip joint. It hurt, but he figured that it was a minor injury that would correct itself over time. But not long afterward, he started to lose sensation in his left arm. Over the next month, people said that he looked different and that his posture was changing. His arm no longer moved when he walked. It wasn't until 2003 that the vague but persistent stiffness in his gait and arm finally drove him to go seek medical advice. At first, doctors thought that it might just be a bad case of carpal tunnel syndrome, but they couldn't find anything mechanically wrong with him when they investigated his wrist. A subsequent battery of tests looked farther up his arm for another source to the problem, ruling out one explanation after another until finally the doctors determined that the root cause must be somewhere in his brain. Eventually, doctors ordered a special scan that required them to inject him with a radioactive dye that would show a characteristic signature of neurological degeneration and decreased dopamine production, one of the only sure signs of Parkinson's disease. It turns out that many cases of Parkinson's begin in a similar way. A small but intense trauma initiates a cascade of stiffness that slowly propagates throughout the entire body, ultimately leading to a progressive and irreversible neurological impairment. Over time, the disease can all but stop the interaction between the peripheral body and the central nervous system. That said, there is no one sure path that Parkinson's disease takes for every person. Michael J. Fox and George H. W. Bush both suffer from Parkinson's, but don't seem to have the same set of disabilities. However, as a general rule, Parkinson's progresses from minor motor symptoms and weakness to an all-encompassing disorder that traps the body in a sort of permanent and constricting cramp, in which every muscle refuses to relax. The end stages are terrifying. A person can be trapped in their body with nothing but searing pain. Such a fate is possible for anyone with the disease, no matter how vibrant they were in their youth, as tragically exemplified in 2016 when legendary boxer Muhammad Ali died after spending his final years mostly paralyzed. Given his diagnosis, Spahns opted to make the most of the time that he had left instead of dwelling on the future. He would take the drugs his doctors prescribed, but wouldn't change a thing about his lifestyle. By throwing caution to the wind, he figured that he would just live a little faster and maybe die a little younger than he would have without the condition. And for a while, it worked. He popped increasingly large doses of medications that physicians assured him would keep his symptoms at bay, knowing that every dose brought with it an incremental amount of resistance. Eventually, he knew that the drugs would lose their effectiveness, and that a wheelchair would just be around the corner. In the early stages, the medication nicely camouflaged the symptoms, as it introduced an influx of dopamine into his fraying neurology. But the relief came at a cost. The number of pills went up. They slowly lost their ability to trick his muscles into action. Then, one morning in March 2011, while he was working at his home computer, his hands just froze in place. Try as he might, he couldn't command his muscles to reach the keyboard. He tried to stand up, but his muscles failed him again. Spahns had finally lost control, and his body had transformed into a knot of painful cramps. It was game over. Later, he'd recall the episode almost with humor. "It was funny," he says. "I was stuck in my chair like a statue, like a noodle of pain. And all I could think was that I should call in sick to work for the rest of that day. In truth, I should have probably quit everything back in 2004 and focused on myself." Spahns isn't entirely sure how long he remained stuck. But what came next changed the course of his life. The stiffness and pain washed over him like a wave until it overcame his mind itself. He fell out of his chair. Then, when Spahns, the IT worker and playboy, was nothing more than the imprint of pain itself, his body shook and shivered with a force that lifted him up off the ground and threw him back down onto the floor. It was as if he was being reanimated by electroshock. The seizure lasted almost a minute, and then, just like that, the pain went away. Spahns was back in control. He stood up like nothing happened. The seizure meant two things. First, his working life was over. And second, so was his ability to keep the symptoms of the disease at bay with medication. His doctor wasn't quite ready to give up hope on medical interventions, though, and suggested that he consider an even more drastic hack into his biology, something called deep brain stimulation. In this procedure, a team of surgeons would implant an electrode into his brain that, in turn, would hopefully give him a few more quality years. It was a tempting offer, but one that he worried would only mask his symptoms further and not combat the underlying problem. As a kid, he'd practiced kung fu and yoga, and while he didn't necessarily believe that he could cure his condition, he thought that alternative therapies could maybe let him manage his symptoms without as many drugs. I first met Spahns in Poland after he decided to put his faith in Wim Hof to help heal his crippled body. At the time, he'd only been doing the program for a few months, and his energy levels were low. But the ice baths and breathing seemed to have a positive effect. While the rest of us could focus on the training, he could only manage 4 hours every day before retreating back into his room to suffer through the symptoms of his disease. It was intimidating to try to talk to him, as if the effort it took for him to form words was siphoning away his energy to do anything else. Still, he saw that there was something to the method that was working. "Having a condition like this makes you intensely aware of your body," he said at the time. Parkinson's made it hard for his brain to communicate with his limbs. But rather than just endure the suffering, he had started to think of every cramp and every shake as an ongoing conversation with his nervous system. Building on Hoff's idea that his body was part of the environment and that his condition meant his brain wasn't able to send strong signals to his muscles anymore, he tried to work backward and use the environment to send increasingly strong signals from his skin to his brain. If he could just find the right combination of external stimuli that might act as commands, then maybe his brain would begin to listen again. It was a leap of faith, but what did he have to lose? Progress was slow, but he was learning. Wim says that the cold is the same as an emotion, said Spons. And that seemed to be true to him. Sometimes the intensity of his anger at his helplessness had the power to break through whatever neurological roadblocks were stopping his brain from communicating with his muscles. But anger was also self-destructive. Using it made him hate himself and resent his condition. Cold showers and ice baths generated similarly intense signals, and he didn't need to jump through any emotional hoops to achieve the intensity he needed to make a breakthrough. He could simply plan baths accordingly. When he started his recovery mission, Spons tracked his drug consumption and uptime on a spreadsheet and then uploaded it to a Facebook page he called Challenging Parkinson's. Within weeks, he was able to show that his overall drug consumption was down, even as he managed to maintain the same number of good hours each day. 3 years after we first met, I traveled to Spons's home outside of Amsterdam to see how he is doing. Living with Parkinson's for 14 years is a feat in itself, so I am not expecting Spons to have many semblances of a normal life. I predict wheelchairs, ramps, and all the medical accoutrements that come with managing a progressive disease. When he greets me at the door, he confides that he almost had to cancel our appointment because the previous night had been a bad one, and he had screamed into his pillow until the early hours. At some point, he expects the tremors to take over and for the system-wide cramps to set in again. I suggest that we can reschedule, but he waves me away. "Let's just see how this goes," he says. For Spons, one small upside of the disease is that he has found time to take up a few hobbies. I don't see any of the medical bric-a-brac I'd expected. Instead, his living room is a mixture of Asian art and a collection of guitars. And there is an unexpected masterpiece in the back of his house. While the symptoms set in, he challenged himself to build an extension onto his cottage that would be part martial arts dojo and part meditation hall. And this he did. A clay stove serves as a place to burn aromatic herbs, and an Indonesian mask hangs from a stud by a bay window. "I started building it in my free time," Spons says. "Sometimes I could just hammer in one board a day, but over time, it all came together." Even though it is a bad day, he shows me that he can still kick a sausage-shaped punching bag that dangles above our heads from the ceiling. I am pretty sure that my leg wouldn't reach as high if I tried. "I can't let this disease stop me," he says, before asking if I would like some coffee. I do. So he brews up a fresh batch as we talk about his morning regimen. Mornings are always the worst. He wakes up stiff as a board and has almost no way to access his limbs. So before the sun comes up, he starts the deep breathing routine that Hoff teaches. It usually takes Spons the better part of half an hour of deep breathing and breath holds before his muscles start to loosen. When he is limber enough, he takes a cold shower to shock his nerves into consciousness. Think of it this way. Parkinson's disease is a degenerative process in which the brain slowly loses connections with the limbs that it is supposed to command. And Spons uses the Wim Hof method to strengthen environmental signals to override his failing neurology. It isn't a cure. It's a management routine. In 2015, he is enjoying 11 and a half hours of good time every day with a lower drug regimen as compared with 2011, when his daily average of good time dipped to less than 7 hours. That progress is more hope than any doctor has given him so far. It's an unorthodox approach, one that his doctors think is nothing more than the placebo effect. But at least Spahn's can speak about his future again. Spahn's is hardly the only person in Holland using Hoff's methods to treat a complex condition. Almost all of the people I meet in Holland who are studying the method because of an illness have a similar story. They start out on prescription drug routines that seem to work at first, but then the drugs lose their effectiveness over time. Each turn to Hoff as a last resort. While the Wim Hof method isn't a panacea for every illness, the most startling recoveries I see in the few weeks I am in Holland occur in people who suffer from autoimmune conditions. These are a few of their stories. The first thing that anyone notices about Hans Emmink is that he's a large man. He has a barrel chest, long, loping arms, and a gut that leads him comfortably. A 3-inch crocodile tooth hangs from a rope around his neck. Despite appearances, he's also the sort of man who is more likely to embrace you in a bear hug than scowl at you from his great height. In 2012, Emmink didn't stand nearly as tall. In fact, most of the time he was bowled over, suffering from painful ulcers that developed throughout his digestive tract. It wasn't just pain. Every time he went to the bathroom, the bowl of the toilet filled with blood. "The first time I saw it, I freaked out," he says to me when I meet him near Hoff's training center. After the first red porcelain bowl, Hans called his doctor, who ordered up a colonoscopy, a procedure that uses a snake-like camera to investigate the colon and intestines. The camera lens captured bright white ulcers every few centimeters. There were hundreds of them. It was Crohn's disease, one of the most common autoimmune disorders in the world today. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, more than 1.6 million Americans suffer from it. About half of the afflicted will at some point require invasive surgery, in which doctors remove whole sections of the patient's severely inflamed and damaged digestive tract. There is no cure for Crohn's, but as with many autoimmune disorders, doctors are often able to keep the worst symptoms at bay with heavy drug regimens, mostly steroids. Limiting or eliminating gluten from the diet also seems to help some people. For Emmink, Crohn's was a living nightmare. Ulcers started in his mouth and proceeded in a line through his esophagus, stomach, large and small intestines, and into his ruined colon. His joints ached so much that it was almost impossible for him to work. The doctors prescribed him prednisone, a common steroid, and initially the symptoms abated. He could function on a daily basis, but the relief didn't last more than a few months. He rapidly built up resistance to the drug, and it wasn't long before he was shitting blood again. So, like anyone with access to Google, he searched for experimental and alternative treatments for the disease. There were thousands online. But one then recent article by Peter Pickers at Radboud University stood out. Pickers' study showed that Hoff was not only able to suppress his own immune system against a foreign toxin, but the following year, the continuing study demonstrated that the skill wasn't only an evolutionary quirk, but teachable. People were musing online that it might be good for any immune problem. So Emmink signed up for the first course he could find. "It's strange to say it, but I started feeling better almost from day one," he says. The worst part of Crohn's for Emmink was the near constant pain, and he found that the breathing alone helped manage those symptoms. As he breathed in more oxygen, he imagined that he was breathing out pain, and the mere visualization made it seem to disappear. Immediately convinced that something was happening, he took regular cold showers and meditated every morning for 20 minutes. "I could feel my body fighting back," he says. "It was remarkable." He also stopped taking the steroids. 15 months later, Emmink booked another appointment with the doctor who'd found the hundreds of ulcers in the first place. This time, there were none. While the doctor was amazed, he wasn't willing to point to a health miracle. Instead, the doctor just gave a shrug and said that while sometimes these things just go into remission, it doesn't mean that the disease was gone. The doctor offered Emmink more steroids, just in case the condition returned, but Emmink declined. If I'd stayed on the meds, I would be falling off a cliff all the time. My health would be terrible, and I'd be bleeding every day, Emmink says now. People with stories like this are everywhere around Wim Hof, and sometimes it's hard to make sense of it all. In the span of just a few days, I meet at least 10 people who claim that Hof has saved their lives. And yet, the skeptic in me is hesitant to point to a specific cause for their miraculous recoveries. As Emmink's doctor correctly pointed out, the medical literature is littered with case studies of people who inexplicably beat the odds. There doesn't always have to be an explanation. Sometimes people just get better. This could just boil down to the placebo effect, the remarkable phenomenon where people who are given a false treatment can show signs of improvement simply because they believe it might help. There's often no physical basis for the recovery, but recover they do. The placebo effect is so confounding to medicine that truly rigorous scientific studies attempt to control for it if they want to prove that one medical intervention or another is actually better than the mysterious voodoo of the body. Clinical trials set up control groups where one patient gets an active drug and the other gets a sugar pill. If a treatment shows that the drug is more effective than a placebo, then it earns a scientific seal of approval and a place on pharmacy shelves around the world. And yet, while chemicals get mounted on a pharmacological pedestal, it's easy to forget that placebos can be incredibly powerful in and of themselves. As reported by the National Cancer Institute in 2003, in cancer trials, placebos can prove to be effective as much as 20% of the time, whereas leading clinical agents rate at 30%. By my math, that means the physical effectiveness of a drug might only be a marginal 10 percentage points over the mystery of self-healing. And it's not just cancer trials. For example, take the hair growth pill minoxidil. In the 1990s, the world learned about minoxidil under the brand name Rogaine, and it was popularized in the Hair Club for Men commercials that played on endless loops on television. In the clinical literature, 63% of men regrew hair when treated with the drug, while 35% of the placebo group reported similar results. This means that positive thinking, or whatever magic happens when you think you might get better, could account for more than half the actual hair-growing power of minoxidil. And that's not even the strangest part of the placebo effect. For whatever reason, there's indication that our placebo responses are actually getting stronger. Recent research out of McGill University in Montreal showed that late-stage clinical trials on pain medications were failing because the placebo responses were actually getting stronger than the drugs. The researchers examined 84 clinical trials for chronic pain published between 1990 and 2013 and discovered that the gap between effective pain treatments and placebos used to be 27%, but by 2013, it had declined to just 9%. For reasons they still can't explain, there appears to be a cultural component. When the same drugs were tested in Europe instead of North America, the placebo effect was only half as pronounced. Anecdotal evidence notwithstanding, it's probably not possible to definitively say that the Wim Hof method is any more effective than the placebo outside of a few studies that have been done in a clinical setting. The people that I meet in Holland might just be success outliers. After all, it makes sense that I'm more likely to meet people who see benefit in the practice than people who abandoned the method after a few days. This, of course, would skew my perspective toward positive results. That said, some stories are just too astounding not to relay. Caspar Vandermeulen was running a race when six skittish-looking horses trotted in a pack as they passed him. One of them bucked and kicked its leg into his body. He doesn't remember the actual strike, nor did he hear the bone snap in his arm. The first thing he can actually remember is the sound of his heart pumping loudly in his ears. When he looked down, he saw a bulge under his forearm, a clear indication that something was seriously wrong. At the very least, the arm was broken. Strangely, in the moment at least, it didn't actually hurt. Enough endorphins rushed through his systems that he felt, well, pretty normal. But when the woman who had been riding the horse came to him in hysterics asking if he'd broken something, he knew that he would have to get to the hospital. "I'm not a doctor, but," he started saying while dangling the awkward and crooked limb for her to ogle. She filled in the rest of the sentence herself. With his good hand, he fished his mobile phone from his marathon vest. It was somewhere mixed in with a pair of peanut butter sandwiches that he'd packed for the race, and called his wife to pick him up. He sounded calm on the phone, so calm that she knew that something was terribly wrong, and she broke into tears before he even mentioned the horse. She jumped in the car and sped toward him. Knowing that she was still a few miles away, Vandermeulen, meanwhile, started focusing on his breathing. He wanted to be ahead of the pain when it finally did set in. Vandermeulen graduated with one of the very first groups of instructors certified to teach the method. Where Hoff can sometimes get lost in his own subject matter and often talks himself through endless tangents about winning the war on bacteria or the importance of universal love, Vandermeulen has the advantage of seeing the underlying principles of a subject and putting them into plain Dutch and English. It helps that his first job out of college was as a science teacher. The occupation required him to break down complex ideas into bite-sized chunks for middle school students to digest. Before that, however, Vandermeulen spent most of his teen years smoking marijuana and playing video games at home. His dietary habits were terrible, and he ate whatever was both available and fast. By the age of 24, he was so grossly out of shape that he could barely run the length of a city block, let alone a mile. His heart beat irregularly, and his blood pressure was always seemingly too high. Worse than that, the 240 pounds he packed on his 6'1" frame made him look a little like Humpty Dumpty, ready to fall off of a wall. Vandermeulen didn't feel well, and figured that he was just depressed. When a therapist suggested that he might benefit from a little exercise, he was horrified. It was the first time that anyone had told him he was out of shape. But his therapist persisted, saying, "You know, sound body, sound mind, all of that." So he started making incremental changes to his lifestyle, first with short, breathless runs around the block, then around the park. He started eating just two large meals a day while fasting the rest of the time,